Hello, welcome back, everybody, to another year of the Sunday Podcast.
I'm Ollie Lum.
And I'm Matt Seddon.
Back in 2025 for our fifth season. You can expect more of this.
He's claiming that he was ill before the semifinal, whatever. But, you know, I just feel like at that point he was just looking for attention.
And some of this.
And you normally say no human is limited. So I can't limit myself, or I can't just say I can do.
As well as event coverage around all the major races on the UK circuit.
And if you're a fan of the pod, please give us a rating and review on your preferred podcast streaming service.
And if you want to stay up to date with all the latest news, give us a follow on Instagram at Sunday Podcast.
As always, thanks for listening. See you next time. And we hope you enjoyed the episode.
Hello, welcome back to another episode brought to you guys by sportsshoes.com. As always, World Cross review incoming. Dave Malarkey's jumping on the call in just a short while as well to review his fabulous performance. Mate, where do you want to start with the World Cross?
The King Kiplimo. Yeah, just a lot to digest, I guess. And I think the big one that a lot of people are taking away from the World Cross is, you know, we had some of the best, I guess, Westerners. We had some of the best Europeans. We had the world champ, Gressier, in town. We had Scrub. We had, you know, America put their best team together, probably bar Grant Fisher. And, you know, would you rate Cole Hocker over the cross country? Not really. They were just missing Grant. You know, I know a lot of people say Connor Mance as well, potentially. So, but they had an incredibly strong team. But I think the thing on everyone's mind is the difference in classes there is still there on the country. And, you know, despite those incredible results from Valencia the day after, it just shows you like how far away sort of Europeans, Americans are over the country. And then I think, you know, you start to brainstorm why that might be. And again, you know, same in the women's race. You look at the first, what was it, Kurgat just outside the top 10, which is a fantastic result for her. Megan Keith was 24th, was she? You know, from our perspective, I know Battaglietti wasn't there. But and you then just, the conversation starts like, well, why are they so much further ahead over the country?
Yeah, I think there's obviously a strength element in the these guys and the women as well just have these massive, massive engines. And I think similarly to the marathon, I almost think you could compare the cross country a bit more to the half and the marathon, where there is still a massive gap compared to the 10K on the track, where maybe I think some of the race craft and just the way these races play out in major championships, where they're not crazy fast. People not get lucky. I don't want to say they get lucky on the track, but it allows a few more people into the race, right? Over the last couple of laps, over the last K. But these cross country races are so strength based, and when you go off so hard, you go off so fast, you're able to make hard moves. Mile in, 2 mile in,
you
on
say,
hilly terrain.
Yeah, you say they're strength based. I do agree with you. They're extremely strength based. But Almgren in this race would not have. I personally don't think he would have featured. And I think a large part of it comes down to, and like Europeans, Americans, whatever, have been able to match the Africans when it comes to just like pure velocity, right? Just running at that even constant speed. They've managed to get themselves to a place, and they've trained in a manner, and I think Jakob instigated that, to get themselves to a place where they can keep up with the Africans on the track. There's nothing that's going to break their rhythm, coupled with the fact they're probably a little bit smarter in races. And I think as well it comes down to preparation. I think they prepare. For example, you look at Tokyo World Champs. Did the Africans prepare for the humidity? No. And what, like, I was in Kenya in August, 3 weeks before the World Champs, and honestly, it was 15 degrees, and it was like misty rain in the air. Obviously, you had some sunny days, but it was nothing. And then I was in Tokyo; it was nothing to what Tokyo was. And I don't think they prepare as meticulously as a European or an American would for those global championships as well on the track. But I look at it, and there's nothing that, you know, the track, there's nothing that breaks a European's rhythm. I think Farah instigated this as well. They're so smart with the way they race. They know their speed. They know if Kenyans or Ethiopians or whoever surge, they know they're not going to be able to sustain it.
Yeah, they just let them go.
They're in tune.
That's what I mean. I think that does come down to strength, though, in a sense. On the country, they surge and they all go with it and they go again because they know it is going to be relentless. Whereas I think on the track, I don't know if it's. To be honest with you, I don't know why they don't do it more.
No, but they can't shake them on the track. They can't shake them on the track. Like Almgren's run the same time as, like, pretty much the same time as someone like Aragawi, like, give or take a couple seconds over a 5K. I think the margins on the track are just not there. Whereas I think
to know that, but you take that top three, right? You take Kiplimo, you take Aragawi and Mbeniyo. If those three in a 10,000 meter track race decided they wanted to just start running stupid splits in a second mile, they could run away with it. I truly believe they could.
Well, they've done it. To be fair, they've done it in Diamond Leagues before. And yeah, I guess the question is, why don't they adopt those tactics at major championships? They never seem to run the race with as much aggression as they do a Diamond League. I do agree with yeah, but I think that's because there's not much to lose if you come second or third in Diamond League. For a global title, there's a lot more to lose, and it'll bank on our kick. And I think, you know, Farah was the first to do this. He knew that he could outfox them a little bit during the race, and as long as he was there with a mile to go, he was then able to get, you know, he had a much better kick than all of them. And, you know, I think that's what we're seeing from Gressier, Anger, and for Jakob, all of these others as well. And so I think that's the route, I guess, Europeans are taking. And I think we're on the country, you look at it and they can just break the, you know, there were so many points on that course where your rhythm was broken. And, you know, I just don't think the Americans, Europeans can handle that at all. You know, they were just out of their comfort zone so early on. And you think, you know, whether it be the sand pit, that roller coaster, like all the little gimmicks and challenges that course had, but also just the speed and the surging. And I just think it's, you know, they don't train in that manner and they don't prepare for it. They don't prepare for cross country. Like, I mean, you look through this field, like.
I was going to say, it goes exactly to the argument you've made about how the Europeans, the US team, they train meticulously to run 10,000 meters on the track by training at an exact pace and working out their exact threshold, et cetera, right? The training of the Kenyans, the Ethiopians, the Ugandans lends itself to cross country in that they will go on runs where they will try and outsurge each other in training. Yeah. How often do we see on the UK circuit where it's frowned upon nowadays to try and drop people on a training run because it's all, we better run in zone two, right? Whereas these guys and these girls are doing it on a day-to-day basis. And yes, they do a lot of jogging and that's well documented, but they also do a lot of runs in a week where they're absolutely going hammer and tongs and they're laying down ridiculous markers on ridiculous terrain at altitude. People forget how hilly Kenya is, how hilly Ethiopia is. And like you say, they are almost preparing perfectly for a cross country.
I must admit, yeah, the ground is very hilly there. And I think, yeah, people do forget that a little bit. And yeah, I mean, we'll talk to Dave, right, about his preparations for the World Cross Country. But I think a large part of it as well is we don't prepare in the same way they do. And we probably have to prepare much more than them because we haven't got, you know, we're not at altitude. We haven't got those rolling trails. You know, they, by the way, everything they do is off road. Like they don't run on roads. You know, you do see videos of like marathon runners and stuff. They obviously pound
it's still like it's a once a week thing where they really hit a targeted session. And when they run on road as well, it's they're running on a main road.
I agree, you know, and you look at the American team, for example, and it's like, yeah, Blanks, sort of Parker Wolf, Kiptu, but, you know, they did one cross country and obviously they don't have professional cross country races to do. So that's all they could do. But I am intrigued to know how they, or sort of understand how they prepared for it. And, you know, I think they're going into this with 2-3 months of preparation. These lot are going into it. I mean, Kiplimo's going into it, the 202 flipping marathon in October. You know, and he's used that foundation to go into the World Cross. And, you know, Aragawi's going into it with having to run his national champs in early November. You know, he's sort of shutting up his track season, hammers the national champs, and then they're in a deep training block for it. And so, whereas you look at how we prepare for a major championships in the summer, and I think it's completely different. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why they are that much further ahead on the country, coupled with the fact it is, you know, they still put a large weighting on the World Cross, whereas, like I said, we'll talk to Dave, but I think Dave had an incredible performance. You look at some of the people he scouted in Nico Young, Morgan McDonald, but will he get the recognition for it over those who went to Valencia and, you know, we caught up a week, went around 27:40, 27:38? Probably not. Yeah, but anyway, should we break the race down a little bit? The World Cross, obviously Kiplimo gets his hat trick.
He's just ridiculous, isn't he? He is is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, let's talk about a course as well, because it's a fabulous course, isn't it? And we said that going into it. Coverage left a bit to be desired in capturing some of the moments on that course in the forest and stuff like that, which is a shame.
It was a big shame. I hate to go on about the coverage. I feel like I hammer coverage probably quite a lot. But
you're a commentator, mate. You're allowed to be critical.
No, but I think it's just so important when you look at the growth of the sport and you look at, like, we're in 2026, for God's sake. I think it is so crucial that you can push out a product that appeals to people. Like, you know, if you watch cyclocross, if you watch cycling, like, it is so polished, you know, and that's why it sits on TNT and they pay good money to, or wherever it sits, you know, and they pay good money and they plow money into the sport. And I just think, you know, most people are used to watching Premier League or Champions League. And I know, you know, completely different ballparks, completely different budgets, etc. But, and the Tour de France, all of these other events, whatever it may be, but like the normal consumer who sits on the couch on a Saturday afternoon is used to watching high budget productions. Like, they're used to getting lots of camera angles, watching it in good quality, really being informed on who is who. And I just think our sport fails us drastically in that department. And I think the World Cross is an easy win, because I get track and field, there are so many names and so many storylines. It is quite difficult to really get that across to the viewer about who's who in all these different disciplines. However, cross country, I mean, they had five races, right? Mixed relay, but, you know, really two big races with those seniors.
Well, the coverage is not as good as the NCAA coverage.
It's not. I was like, what?
That's ridiculous.
But like you think about Kiplimo, why isn't there a couple VTs before the race on the big hitters, right? People would have turned that on, not really knowing who Kiplimo, Aragawi or Benyo were, or who Gressier was, you know. So why isn't there a bit of, you know, a couple VTs introducing these guys, showing Kiplimo winning the last couple World Crosses, showing Aragawi, showing Ngetic, you know, and of course some of the Americans who would have been the hometown favourites. That sort of thing, getting people a little bit more engrossed in what they're about to watch. And then, of course, yeah, they needed more cameras out on the course, I think. You know, they needed more static cameras. The drone up in the sky sapped the atmosphere for me. They were like little ants running around, and it was difficult to see where people, you know, you could sort of see gaps, but other than that, you couldn't really see who was who. So, yeah, I think that was a shame. But obviously, in the moment, I mean, they had some amazing things there. They had a huge, you know, true American fashion, they had a massive marching band on the course. Like, why isn't that being filmed? I want, you know, jazz us up a little bit, show us the stature of this event.
Yeah.
So I think from that point of view, it was a bit frustrating. I just get frustrated because I'm like, our sport is amazing, but people, if they turned that on, they wouldn't have that same opinion, I don't think.
No, and because there's no context and there's no understanding of what these guys are doing and who they are. So,
but Eurocross was much better.
You talk about the drone in that, where it's like weaving in and out around a course, and you're getting an appreciation for the pace these guys are running at Eurocross.
Yeah, I thought Eurocross coverage was great. But anyway, yeah. So, but hey, let's talk about the race. I mean, yeah, Kiplimo, 2:38, ninth kilometer. Kind of, he's adopted that tactic quite a few times, and I knew that. Yeah, there'd become a point in that race where he would just put his foot down and pull away. But I mean, 2:38 is just 28:18 for 10K. I mean, where would that put him in Valencia? Around Tallahassee, just staggering stuff, really. Very, very impressive. And poor Aragawi and Abeno just could not live with him at all, really, could they?
No, they certainly couldn't, mate. And but a nice split across the podium, Uganda, Ethiopia, Kenya, and the same three on the women's side. So no massive domination by one of the nations like there was last time out now in that women's race. And obviously in Ngetic taking the win, her first win, compared to you mentioned Kiplimo's third. He joins Paul Turgat, he joins Bekele as the men to have won three world cross country titles, which is just he is certainly something else. And I think every time you watch Kiplimo, every time I watch Kiplimo as well, like, you're just in awe of the way he tackles turns, tackles hills, makes surges, and just looks like he's
Look easy.
Yeah, it's something truly something to behold. And I think it goes back to your point as well about
the coverage of if you really celebrate a guy like this, because Kipchoge, for example, I think he's very similar in it, and that's why he's become so popular with the mainstream, is because he has that about him when it comes to the marathon. But cross country, no one cares.
Yeah, I agree with that. He does, you know, Kip Lima does make it very, very impressive. And I would love to see him go more. I think, unfortunately, I mean, they're not even sure when the next World Cross is going to be. Not even sure. You know, it hasn't been confirmed. You know, it should really be the Olympic year 2028. But they say they want to move it to odd years, right? So they're like, well, probably be 2029. But then obviously there's no venue or anything like that. I mean, it is 3 years away. But it is a concern. I think it's, funnily enough, I was reading a W article, Jason Henderson, basically suggesting that cross country needs the Winter Olympics more than the Winter Olympics needs cross country. Like, that's for sure. And I think, is it quite lazy from World Athletics and SEBCO to just try to get cross country instead of making it its own event and making it exciting? Is it lazy of them to go, let's just get it in the Winter Olympics, get it in the Winter Olympics, and then that'll do all the PR and drive all the excitement about this event that we need?
Yeah, potentially, because you look at all the, realistically, right, you look at all the top sports in the world that are making money, are watched by everyone, and they're non-Olympic sports.
Yeah, this is the thing.
The biggest competitions, right, the Champions League, right, the World Cup, so they're run by the federation. So actually the world champs should be
huge.
Should be the top of the top, right? Yeah. You look at tennis is exactly the same. Golf is the same. I'm trying to think about what the popular sports are now.
No, you're right.
Yeah. It's not going to solve all the problems, is it? I think it would be cool. Like, don't get me wrong. I guess if you grow up in running, everyone wants to be an Olympian. So to have that opportunity
for the athletes is amazing.
Cross country is great. But to grow the sport, I don't know if that's the answer.
I agree with that. I think for the athletes, it'd be amazing. It'd be super exciting for them that they could be an Olympian, both a winter and a summer Olympian. Mm-hmm. And it would definitely drive, I think, the desire to participate in trial races and stuff like that, because I think, you know, rather than just the World Cross, I think that Olympics is just another notch up, isn't it? So it would be great. But I do think, yeah, from a sport perspective, I mean, what would happen? It would sit in a massive Olympic program. It would be a one-off race on, you know, within the Winter Olympics, where lots of other sports are headline sports. And it would probably bypass everyone. You know, it would come and go quite quickly. And would it engage new audiences as much, like, potentially? But I actually think, you know, this debate of does it need to go into Winter Olympics, I think I would love to see it in the Winter Olympics, but at the same time, I think it's just a lazy answer to saving cross country. It's a lazy approach. I think, you know, there is a sport, and when it's run well and done well, it's amazing. And that shows by how many people on the ground in Tallahassee enjoying themselves, and the atmosphere, which looked to be on the ground, looked exceptional. But obviously that, for me, that just didn't come across in the coverage. So anyway, there we are. Getic in a slightly different fashion, mate. 2:55 first K, completely breaks the field. What was she, just outside 9 minutes for the first 3K? You know, she would have had a place in the men's race for the first 2K. I think the men were 5:45 or sort of 2:50 for that first K. And that was a front.
Kip Lima, not even anywhere near the front.
No, he sits back early on, and you could tell it was, you know, Wesley Kiptoo led it for a bit. Face Kai Robinson was in top three for a while. I think he was, you know, floating around, pushing things on. And I think for those guys who are in the NCAAs, I think they're actually a bit surprised. They were like, this is a similar sort of speed as the NCAA. If not, I think Kai Robinson said it felt a bit slower, felt easier than some of his NCAA starts that he'd raced. But the problem is, it moves. You know, the NCAA, that's the fastest they run. Is the first couple Ks, whereas this,
well,
it's
like our favorite piece of commentary, mate. This it's like basically like find your place in the first mile, because after that you're not going to be 10 or 15 places further forward or further back, because you simply can't get past people in the NCAA cross. And then it's just one big swamp. Like you say, when they move, there's less people in the race, or less people competing, certainly. Yeah, when they go, they do go. And you mentioned the 9K. I think about just before halfway, he starts taking a bit closer order, doesn't he? And yeah, and then it's game over.
Oh, it's close order. I mean, he hammers. Yeah. So, but you know, on that women's race, one of the largest winning margins we saw, only second to Greta Weitz of Norway, obviously back in the day, which the Hannah Egeland made us all aware that that was over a 4K cross country. She won by 44 seconds. I mean, that is unbelievable. But yeah, let's dive into Megan Keith's performance. Fair play to her. And actually, I thought she did very well too. She spoke after how it's just the world's hardest race. And I think a lot of people don't quite realize that. But yeah, for Megan to say that, I totally believe her. And I think just from watching the World Cross previously, it is, especially on that sort of ground, it's just so fast and relentless. And she did get after it for a large part. She was in the top 15. You know, she was hanging around 14th, 15th, 16th. And unfortunately, just fell apart on that last lap. But held
that's
it
the
together.
Way to do it, though.
It is the way to do it. But I think she'll be disappointed. Two Irish women, you know, Everard and Niamh Allan, by the way, both had stellar runs, both beat Megan Keith. I think she will be a bit gutted with that, considering she put them away by some margin at the European Cross.
Yeah, but I think, and the reason I say this is the way to do it, because I think Keith can come away from that race and think, look, I put myself in there and I gave myself a chance of coming in the top 15, coming in the top 10. And I realized, like, I'm not quite strong enough. Whereas if you go off conservative, you never even give yourself a chance. And maybe you finish stronger and you feel better and you look better and you pass a few people. But the standard is too high to let them get away. And it's exactly what she's going to face in the summer. Not necessarily this year, but certainly next year and in the next majors, where you have to get on it. Like, you're 10,000 meters on the track. You can't let these top athletes go. And the only way she's ever going to produce a performance where she's matching them is if she keeps doing this and keeps learning to get on the train and go with them and see for how long she can handle it. And it's almost that, it's almost like seems a naive approach, but I think it's actually the mature approach as well.
Yeah, I think it's almost like a transition period, like you said. Yeah. She needs to adapt to that style of racing. I would agree with that. But, you know, that being said, she was fifth European. Ferrero, who won the under-23s Eurocross, she was the first European home. And then you had Sarah Larty, then you had Allan, Everard, and then Megan Keith. And there were three Americans ahead of Keith as well. So, yeah, hats off to her for the way she ran. But I think her overall performance, she'll be a little gutted with coming 25th at the World Cross Country Championships. And in the position 10 to 20 was packed by, you know, Australians, Europeans in that women's race. I think Lauren Ryan, huge run, ex-FSU Australian. Australia nailed it. And I think in the men's race as well, they've always got people around that, you know, they had Kai Robinson, Ed Marks, always around that 20th mark. They won the mixed relay. We haven't even spoke about that.
Yeah.
I think they are a really strong nation at the moment, and credit to them. But I think a lot of those Australians are based in America. And so I think they really are, you know, they were very much in tune with this World Cross Country in Tallahassee. I mean, they're pretty much their whole team in the mixed relay was American based, and across both races, the ones who were based in America ran better as well in the men's and women's than those who were based in Australia.
Yeah. When did the British team travel? Do you know?
I don't know, mate. I just don't know. Wednesday, Thursday. No, it wasn't much before. Just looking on socials, I think people were starting to put stuff up. They touched down maybe Wednesday or Thursday.
Because it makes a big difference. It doesn't. If it was a major track championship, they'd be flying in a lot further out.
Yeah, it goes to what we said. Like, you'd be in a, you know, if you were doing the world 10,000 meter final, you'd be in a holding camp for a month.
Mm-hmm.
Getting used to the climate and everything like that. And obviously, the World Cross is even harder than a World, because you've got half marathon runners, you've got 5K runners, you've got 10K runners, and you've got track people, road, and you've got from each team, which for an African, which makes it even harder. But yeah, it's just not treated with that same care. And I think that's why we, on the face of it, we just don't match the Africans. So anyway, the rest of the British team on the women's side, yeah, Poppy Tank. Top 30 for her is that was a bloody good run, I thought. 29th, that was huge from her. And again, like, on the country, she is closing that gap to Keith. I think Poppy Tank is one to watch over the next couple of years from a European cross perspective. We talk about potentially future World Cross. And then Ockenden, 41st, and then Phoebe Anderson. Phoebe Anderson, sorry, 35th, Ockenden, 41st.
Yeah, and of course, going to chat to Malarkey Malarkey in a bit. 26th place for him, I think, yeah, fantastic run for him. Again, though, like you said, based over in the US and certainly using that to his advantage. The rest of the British men, Matt Ramsden down at 53rd.
Big performance from Ramsden, though, I think. And it's funny, you know, the two men who probably came under the most heat for going to this World Cross Country Championships and being selected delivered. And so, yeah, fair play to the selectors. They obviously got it right on Malarkey and on Ramsden. And I think, yeah, probably Ramsden's performance at the Europeans on that firm ground was indicative of what he could do in Tallahassee and Malarkey's preparation, which we're going to get into how he prepared for the World Cross. But even though the fact he didn't race cross country, he was obviously in a good spot. And that matched Barnico's performance from a couple of years back. I think 26th, or was Barney 24th or something?
Yeah, and Jacob Cowan and Rory Leonard 71st and 79th, and I think Leonard will be the one who's the most disappointed with that.
Oh, yeah, it's tricky for Leonard. I think
it's so hard though, isn't it? That's
because I'll be honest, like 20th.
If you look at it now and be like, oh, I should have gone to Valencia. Do you know what I mean? That's the, and I'm sure he is thinking that, but I think I'm glad he wanted to go and compete there though.
But I wonder, the people who raced well, by the way, at World Cross, I mean, Brian Fay had a bloody huge run. The people who raced well did work through at World Cross. They did. They came from a little bit further back. And Leonard early on, you know, even he was ahead of Malarkey for the first lap. And Malarkey worked through and really held his own, because I think there was a point in that race where if you started to fall off on sort of lap two or three, you just went back. You know, backwards from there quite badly. You needed to have some sort of momentum going into lap three, lap four, just to not let that race get away from you. And I wonder what Rory's goal was prior. Like, was he hoping for a top 20? Was he hoping for a top 30, top 40? But, you know, to be honest, I would say that 17th, where did he count Eurocross? 17th? I would be honest, like, that is about 50th. You know, that your 17th Eurocross, you then add in, you know, I know you're taking some men out, but you add in the whole American team, you add in pretty much the whole French team, you add in, you know, what's that, 18 people from the African nations, Uganda, Ethiopia, Kenya, and then probably just a couple of others. You know, they had Tanzanians and stuff like that. So once you add Australians, I mean, you add those in the mix and you're coming 50th, aren't you? So, and I think he sets off wanting more, and then it becomes very difficult, because the minute you go backwards at the World Cross, I mean, the quality behind you just cut you open, really.
Yeah. Yeah, but, and that is one thing I do like about Leonard. He's not scared to have a swing and put himself out there, and he'll be, of course.
Yeah, fair play finish, because it probably would have been easy not to finish, but obviously he had to. He was the last man, needed to get Britain as a scoring team. Quite a few boys did drop out. I mean, Mo Ahmed dropped out, for example. He'd had enough.
Yeah, I've had a stink of the house bigging him up before.
I told you, I think we might have seen the best of him. I think He's on the way out, is my own. But yeah, words on the American team. I mean, I thought Parker Wolf, great run. Kipchoge solid, but Blanks, Nico Young, disappointing.
Yeah, I think Blanks has had an all right run, to be honest with you. I think Nico Young's, he's not better than 36th, because that's where he's come, but I expected him to be better than 36th place.
Yeah, it took Nico a while to sort of really feature on the NCAA cross scene. I don't know how he's struggled. I mean, both him and Blank struggled in their trial, and I thought that was a bit of a, you know, red flag for me. I thought, you're getting put away in your trial, I think you're going to struggle in a month to turn that around. Because the guys ahead of you are, you know, are legit contenders.
Mm-hmm.
But Parker Wolf does really impress me. But again, you know, you look at his summer, he was probably able to get into work a little bit easier earlier than Blanks and Young. So that probably helps him quite a lot. And he's probably 2 months further along than those boys. So yeah, I expect to see some quick times coming out of Blanks and Young. I have no doubt about that in the next.
Hey, what he does do though, is it, we talk about these Americans, but it shows the strength of the European cross, because you've got Ndeken Nwanyayu, 8th place. You've got Jan Schrub, 7th place. Gressier, of course, in 15th place, Faye in 16th place, and these are big performances from Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
In there,
yeah, we said before, I think there is a bit of a American bias as well against, you know, matching up against, but yeah, we're getting there. But unfortunately, I think we won't ever put the same weighting on the World Cross, because now we're not going to see another one for 3 years at least. So it's now going to go on the back foot for a lot of for a lot of Europeans' minds. I have no doubt if this was an annual event, we would see Europeans feature in the pointy end like we do on the track.
Imagine it was like the European Cross in the
you
have the same trial race every year as well, and you're picking it from people that 2 weeks before are in the best shape.
It's a different story, isn't it?
We need to host it, mate, and then people will then they'll target.
Well, yeah, rumors are we might host the Eurocross. Anyway, buddy, let's go hear from Dave Malarkey, because he did have a fantastic run. And yeah, I think punched way above his weight, took some huge scalps out there. And what's next for this man in 2026?
Hey, how are we doing, lads?
How's it going, mate? You okay?
Good. Yeah, good. How are you?
Yeah, good. We've just been reviewing the World Cross, and then you're going to slide in nicely, hopefully, to add to our little review app. So yeah, appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks for having me.
Mate, you sound just like Cavendish. We got Mark Cavendish in the building.
You reckon? It's a bit of a weird accent. It's like a mix of everything. It's just like, yeah. Everyone thinks I'm Australian over here, so.
Today, that's classic. But mate, I mean, how's things been since what you've been up to last week, man? Just relaxing?
Yeah. Post-Worlds, just got back. I actually just moved apartments, so trying to figure all that stuff out. It's all like chucked in the spare bedroom right now, so yeah.
Where are you based in? I know you're based. I know you've been in Flag, but
yeah, still in Flagstaff. Yeah, I'm just burning through my savings in Flagstaff right now. So that's. I was going to say,
you trying to make that long term stay in Flag, or just doing like extended stints?
So I actually had some credits left at NAU to finish last semester, and then so I finished that off in December, and now I'm just like living out here as long as I can afford it. So.
Yeah, which isn't too long in Flag. It's an expensive place to be.
Definitely, yeah. It's going down pretty quickly. I'm just glad the exchange rate between the pound and the dollar is pretty strong right now. Otherwise, I would not be in a good place.
How can you get through the indoor season, or are you going to be home before then?
Yeah, should be indoor season through a little bit of the summer. So yeah,
okay, trying
to get a contract together. So hopefully. Yeah. We can stay here a bit long term, but yeah.
How does that feel, right? Like day to day, you're almost watching the bank account go down, right? And you're doing it to chase the dream. I mean, so what's your mindset like doing that? Do you feel more pressure than when you're in the NCAA, or is it something that's driving you to go and train harder?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, when you're in the NCAA, you get your scholarship. So, I mean, it's not a lot, but there's still money coming in. Yeah. So it you're not really thinking about it as much. You can pay for your rent, pay for your food, and you can get by. But yeah, I mean, definitely the start of like September, October, it was definitely getting to me a little bit, you know, like things weren't progressing with the contract how I'd like. And, you know, you are watching that bank account run down, but
yeah.
I think eventually it's just that realization, like, you know, like, okay, yes, I'm burning through my savings and there's not a lot of money left, but, you know, I don't want any regrets when this is done. Mm. And I just had that realization, like, this is exactly what I want to be doing. You know, it's if it runs out and I haven't got a contract, then that's it. I have to go home, get a job or whatever. At least I know that moving forward, I've given everything that I could, and, you know, I think that kind of took the pressure off a little bit. And I think just getting back to racing as well. Like, I love racing, and, you know, it's like having that fun and enjoyment with racing was like a big part. So yeah, I was like, definitely in November when I started to do a few road races, it was like, that was a bit of like a relieving factor, I guess.
I mean, and they went well. You must have picked up some prize money in those. They were big races you did.
Yeah, they were big races. So yeah, yeah, they definitely helped out a little bit, but yeah.
What about because go on, mate. Yeah, sorry.
I was just saying, it's always nice to know you can like drop onto the roads and try and pick up a bit of money of you if I need to. But
yeah,
definitely need a bit of stability long term, because you know with running, nothing's guaranteed.
No, I think that's one of the toughest things about it that people underestimate when you know we sit here and we judge people's performances, and you guys are going through, you know, these sorts of periods in your life where, like you say, you can look at your bank account and it's just money's just going out. But I think, you know, you were on a team where a lot of guys would have had nil deals. Were you ever trying to seek a nil deal, or was that kind of never on the cards for you because of the timing and when you joined NAU, etc.?
Yeah, it's you learn with contracts there's a lot more to it than you would have thought. And yeah, I think it's just sometimes there's luck of the draw with what brands want at certain times. You know, a lot of with distance running now, it's a lot of like, if you're a 5-10K guy on the track, their first question is like, when are you going to the roads and when are you doing a marathon? And it's just like, it's like, hang on, I only just moved up to the 10K, you know, I ran my first 10K in March. And like moving to the roads is definitely something that I want to do moving forward, but like, that takes time and, you know, and stability within your life as well. Like I can't risk transitioning to half marathons and marathons when, you know, the safer bet is just to stick with the 10Ks for the time being. But I think all you can do is kind of just keep trying to perform and putting marks down and, you know, hopefully that's gathers the interest of brands. And I think like definitely the races that I've just done have definitely been helpful. So
let's talk about last weekend then, 26th in the world. How does that stack up then against like your other performances, and do you think that will help you, I guess, get what you want in terms of contracts and places moving forward?
Yeah, I definitely think each race that I've done has kind of been a step up. And I think, you know, I knew top 30 was definitely realistic, but putting that together on the day is easier said than done, especially when it's, you know, cross country is a little bit more unpredictable than the roads, I'd say. You know, it's harder to judge paces, to judge groups. They've added obstacles in, which is like, who has experience running over these obstacles for 10K? Like, nobody. So it's just that, you know, putting that together on the day is the big thing. And I think 26th was a reflection of like my races that I've done previously, but also the training and everything that I've done over the past 4 or 5 months. Yeah.
Yeah. 26th, and you beat some big, you know, big names, you know, Nico Young, Morgan McDonald, there's a few others in there that I can't remember, but yeah, you beat some good guys in that. And I'm intrigued, what was your preparation like going into it? I mean, you had the advantage of being at FSU. You kind of one of the few people who actually had run on that course quite a lot. You knew it well. So did you train for the course a little bit as well, knowing what was to come?
Yes and no. I think it's like, you can't really practice for those obstacles.
No.
The course is completely like, it's a similar, like I knew the routes and stuff like that, but it's like, you know, with those obstacles and stuff, it was a completely different dynamic. I think the main thing was, it's just knowing how the humidity feels. Everyone goes on about the heat, but for me, it's more the humidity that is the issue. You know, I think it was like 90% humidity, sure, yeah, like the morning of the race. So it's like dealing with that is like, I think with the humidity, like, you get the deeper you get into the race and the closer you are to redlining, like if you overheat, the humidity just makes it so much worse. And I think having been in Florida in August, like I don't know if any of you have been to Florida in August, but it's awful to train in. It's you're like wringing your shorts out after an easy run. So it's like, no, I knew that I could race in those conditions, and it kind of just takes away that element of like unpredictability. I knew what to expect in terms of the conditions, more so than the course, in my opinion.
Good point.
Yeah, so were you up in Flag then till just before, and you just dropped
down? Yeah, so I flew down on the Wednesday before the race. So yeah, 3 days before, yeah.
And what's, you know, I guess, yeah, you had the advantage, you knew what that humidity feels like, but how's training been? I mean, you've had a pretty, I mean, even if we rewind, you know, grew up in the Isle of Man, what was it like growing up there? And then, you know, then you go out to university, FSU, NAU, you've had a pretty unique career in that sense, and you've mixed and got to know some impressive coaches and be around, you know, also impressive athletes in really good environments as well.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, grew up on the Isle of Man for 18 years. I mean, they've for how small of a place it is, that they've got a pretty good setup actually, and they've got sport aid to help you get in and off the island, which is a massive help, because, you know, like as a kid, like it adds up pretty quickly if you're trying to get off the island pretty quickly. But yeah, I had a coach there, a couple coaches there actually, Graham Davis and Andy Fox. I think they were great in kind of like holding me back, but like getting a taste of training and like what it's like to try and perform at a decent level. But yeah, and then I moved to Leeds and was under Andy Henderson, a great coach. And I think we both learned a lot during that period. I think, you know, he was probably more of an 800 coach when I first got there, but I think with Phil Sessman being there, he's learned so much about like the aerobic stimulus and like building the engine and stuff like that. So I think, yeah, training adapted with him as I was there. And I think I saw a lot of really good progress. I was a 13:43 guy when I think I left him.
Flipping hell, I must have arrived. What did you arrive as?
15:21. Yeah. So in a 3-4 year stint, I think that was a lot of progress. And I actually applied to a master's in Leeds, but I got waitlisted. So that's why I decided to go out to the NCAA. And I got in touch with Coach Brayman at FSU, and he's a great guy, and he helped me through the whole process. And yeah, again,
why
just
did you get in touch with him?
So I was actually with an agency called Scholarbook reached out, and they put me in touch. So I was speaking to like Virginia Tech, Portland, and FSU. But I think I just connected really well with Brayman, and he's got a good history with the Brits. I think, like,
yeah,
you know, Luke Gunn, all those guys back in like 2010-ish, around that era, were like, they were all out there. So yeah, just sparked my interest. And actually, Ahmed Muhammad, who's on the NAZ team right now, he ran 27:03 over the summer. He was the assistant coach at the time, and he's such a great guy. And you know, I think speaking to him just like kind of eased that, like, the nerves of going out to the NCAA. And yeah, I think it was more just like, I mean, on paper, there was definitely better schools to go to, but I just connected with Coach Brayman and FSU pretty well.
Yeah, because FSU was an interesting time for you because you were one of the stronger guys. The team, fair to say, the team was going through quite a heavy rebuild process. Like, it wasn't the team of old. And it was very much you were the man, I guess. So how did you find that?
Yeah, so like a school like FSU is trying to compete on all fronts with sprints, hurdles, like all jumps as well. I think it's so they've got a limited amount of scholarships they put to distance. Mm-hmm. So you kind of see them going through these bit more of a waves than your distance schools like NAU, who are just constantly recruiting the best recruits in the country. So yeah, I went during probably a bit of a rebuild period. The team got a lot better when I was there, but yeah, it's definitely an interesting dynamic because, you know, all the pressure's kind of put on the front end of the team, you know, like you're leading the guys out every race. But yeah, I think I dealt with that pretty well. I think, you know, it was a big change because obviously in the UK it's a lot more individual. You've got your club system and you can race at like cross relays and stuff, but most of the time you're just racing for yourself. So I actually found it quite motivating to have that, like, you know, people relying on you almost. It's not just you're running for yourself. So yeah, I quite enjoyed it. I enjoyed the team system over here.
Yeah, and talk about obviously the move to NAU, because I think there's something that, as I guess fans of the sport based in the UK, it's exciting to see a British guys going out to the biggest cross country school in the NCAA. So when it happened, I think we're all like, wow, let's see what he can go and do. And obviously, yeah, like we said last weekend, you're seeing the kind of benefits of that. But talk about how it all happened moving over to NAU.
Yeah, for sure. So Coach Brayman retired the summer before I transferred. So it's kind of like a, you know, you've got a limited window in the NCAA to transfer. I think it's like a 30 to 60 day window where you've got to enter the portal and start speaking to coaches. So yeah, he retired and I made a very quick decision to go in the portal just to know what coach I was going to have for the year coming up.
And it's a risk, isn't it? Sorry, just to cut you off. Like, when you go into the portal, you can't go back out. That's like, you're just in and it's whatever new school you get picked in, right?
Yeah, your scholarship is gone. They don't have to honor your... They kept... Like, FSU could have brought me back, but they don't have to honor that scholarship anymore. So, yeah, so it's a little bit of a risk. And thankfully, you know, I was... There's not many, too many sub 13:30 guys that enter the portal every year, because when you're at that level, you're probably pretty secure with your coach. And thankfully, NAU reached out. You know, I think the amount of transfers that have gone to NAU under the Smith era is probably a handful on the men's guys. It's probably 4, maybe 5. And yeah, thankfully they reached out. And, you know, I think it was a pretty easy decision to make the transition up to altitude and to be training under Coach Smith in his final year in the NCAA. But yeah, like, an amazing experience. Like, I have never learned so much. I didn't think when I'd get to like 24, 25 that I would be learning as much as I did at NAU, but like, it's crazy. Like, not just in terms of trainer philosophy, but how they approach racing and competition, like working as a team. Like, it's like, you start to understand why they are as good as they are, because they are like, they are a professional setup without being professional. You know what I mean? It's like as high as amateur as you could get.
Tell us more. Firstly, I think that race approach to it, this is interesting. how do they approach races, like as a team? What are those discussions like before races of different levels?
Yeah, I think it's just how you like mentally process what's about to happen. Like Coach Smith would, like, if you like had any concerns before the race, he was like, I do not care how you feel because I know you are going to go out and do a job. It was just like, I think a big realization for me was like, you don't realize it's been put in your head until you actually like experience some like difficulties. Like before pre-nats last year, I fell over and completely bust my knee open. It was like swollen. I hadn't ran for a full week and it was like swollen when I raced. And he was just like, obviously give me the option to race or not. And I was like, look, I'm going to do it. Like it's for the team. We need to get points to qualify for nationals. And there wasn't one part during the race where I was like, even thinking about my knee, I was thinking about the process of racing. So it becomes a, yeah, I mean, I could speak for days about this, but like it's, he's very much like process orientated, not about like the outcome of what's about to happen. So like, if you go into to do a time trial, let's say you're trying to break 28 minutes in the 10K, it's not for 1 second should you be thinking about, I want to run 28 minutes. It should be like, how am I going to run 28 minutes? Like, what do I need to be thinking about? Like, how am I going to break down this race into segments, whether that's K segments, 5K segments? And, you know, during at the end of the race, you shouldn't be thinking, I've got to run a 64-second lap to break 28 minutes. It should be like, your technique, like breaking down the individual parts of that, like, do I need to cover moves? Do I need to like, yeah, like not 1 second should you be thinking about outcomes. So I think that was like a big thing for me. And I think it's helped me stay a lot more calm during races and really like, you know, being able to break down races and process them a lot more.
Mate, like yeah. I mean, yeah, World Juniors was impressive. What was that? Brian Massal, yeah, second to him twice. And I think that what you've just described showed in the World Cross as well, because I think that's a race which can get away from you quite quickly if you're not focusing on exactly what you're doing at different sections around that course. You know, you did, it did show your sort of composure, but also your experience, I guess, that you mentioned in the humidity as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think you saw a lot of guys going off with that lead group, and I think, you know, I think they struggled at, it's easy to get wrapped up. And like, I think especially like these are got, yes, I've raced some of the NCAA guys before, but a lot of them are NCAA champions. Like I've never been close to like Graham Blanks. I think I was like 15 seconds behind him and that will like over the weekend, but like he's usually a minute in front of me. So, okay, these are guys that I race, but am I, I've never really been racing them before. You know what I mean? They're like miles ahead of me. Like they're not in the same race as me. So I think it was like a unique experience in the fact that like, you don't really know where to position yourself. So it's just like thinking during the race, like, how does this feel at any given time? And like moving up, like, I think it helped like judging off like Brian Fay came storming through and stuff. So like jumping on them when you feel good and stuff like that helps carry it through a little bit as well.
Right.
You mentioned earlier that you kind of had top 30 in your sights. At what point did you think, I want to do the World Cross and this is something that I'm going to focus on, I'm going to aim for?
Yeah, I think coming off the back of summer, it was definitely something that I was targeting. I mean, yeah, unfortunately, my visa's like changing status in the US, so I wasn't allowed to leave the US. I'm a big believer in that we should be doing trials and we should be like picking the guys from the trials. So unfortunately, like I would have loved to come back for Euros and race Euros, but it just wasn't possible at the time. So, you know, it was leaving it to the subjective opinion of the selection committee, and thankfully they picked me, but like at the end of the day I couldn't have been annoyed if they decided to go a different route.
Did you feel pressure going into the weekend knowing that you've been picked ahead of those other guys? Because it's something that Matt and I spoke about, I think last week. We were like, it's a great pick in that, and it was nothing against you at all, but you got a feel for the other guys, but there's pressure then on you to outperform the guys that are in from Euros and then of course the guys who aren't there as well.
Yeah, for sure. I don't think I thought about it too much. I listened to your podcast the other week, so I was like, oh, I'm going to prove these guys wrong.
We can't even pretend.
Don't worry, I heard every word of it. It's understandable. I'm definitely a big believer in trials. I think we've seen too much in the past where people have skipped trials and probably weren't deserving to be at championships. You know, running fast times a lot earlier in the season, not at their fittest during things. So yeah, I think, you know, definitely we should be doing trials as much as possible. It's a weird time of year, I understand that, but yeah. Definitely.
So on that, yeah. So on that, you knew you had to prove fitness in certain road races.
Yeah. That was the goal of those races, and in November was to one just like race, because I'm a big believer in racing. I don't think you should be doing 6 to 8 month blocks of training. No. So, but yeah, just prove fitness. I mean, I was also entered into Houston Half Marathon, which was the day after World Cross. So if I wasn't selected, there was a plan there to do that as well. So yeah.
Fair, mate. Let's talk about training philosophy a little bit, as you know, specifically when you're at NAU, because you know, were you under Mike Smith for a period, and then who took you through this last 6 months, or you know, this last semester that you've just finished up?
Yeah, so I've actually been self-coached since July. Really? Yeah, self-coached since July. So, I mean, I say self-coached, and yes, self-coached in the moment, but it's the way I see it is I'm just applying what I've learned previously with coaches. You know, like Mike Smith's one of the best coaches in the world. Like, he can't get much better. So, you know, I'm just applying what I've learned off him, what I've learned off Coach Brayman, Andy Henderson, even my coaches back in the Isle of Man, like Andy Fox and Graham Davis. Like, I'm just applying what I've learned previously to what I'm doing quite right now. Yeah. And there's no excuses not to like understand the physiological benefits of each training type. You know, there's so many research papers and podcasts and, you know, guys that are at the top level speaking about their training. There's no excuse not to understand the science behind it all. So yeah, pretty typical in terms of like double threshold, but also getting that neuromuscular stimulus with like hills and some faster repeats on like Fridays and stuff like that. I've also been, if you look at my Instagram, I've done a few stuff with the Under Armour team up here. Cause
you saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. Haas is my agent and he coaches that team as well. So when it's fit into what I want to do, I also jump in with those guys, which has been a help when needed. Yeah.
And is that something that, I guess you obviously can't speak too much, but in terms of groups and things like that, is that what you're looking for? Are you looking for a group to go and sign with, or are you looking for someone that's happy to support you to keep coaching yourself? What's the ideal scenario?
Yeah, I think ideally a group. You know, as a professional, I'd be coming in at the lower end of that range. You know what I mean? You suddenly, like, there's a long way. I've got a long way to go in terms of being at the top of professional level. So if I could get into a group and kind of learn off those guys, I mean, I think, yeah, not just like in terms of training with those people, but just like learning how they do things. I mean, I think a big one for me when I was in Leeds was Phil Sessman. Like, learned so much off that guy. And he is like, I mean, I'm not going to say too much because I don't want to boost his ego too much, but like, he was a big help in terms of like helping me take that step up. You know, it was just me and him during COVID, and just like, we were the only guys that could get onto the track. So like, you know, people like that just like help you reach that next level. And so, yeah, I think a group would be ideal.
Yeah, I think Sessman's, I guess, just precision in the work that he does would definitely rub off on those around him who are lucky enough to train with him day in, day out.
Yeah. I mean, he's just a grafter, and he's done the research and stuff. He works with physiologists and Andy Henderson a lot. So, yeah, just, yeah. I don't want to say inspiration because he's never going to let me hear the end of it, but somewhere along those lines.
Who's okay on that, actually? So you train with Sessman, he you know, he was a great figure for you to sort of look up to and learn from. Who's the, I guess, just biggest dog that you've trained with? Like, you must have trained with some absolute beasts at your time in the States, especially NAU.
yeah, there's, I mean, Nico jumped into the odd workout last year, but we didn't do anything crazy with him, honestly. Just like, yeah. Bosley's like, he's done some, like, he had me on the ropes in some workouts last year. I didn't even finish some of the workouts. Like, I was like fully cramping up, and he's like talking to me. Like, we were doing like this like flush workout of like mile and a half, where we drop from like 60 to 68 each lap, and it's just fluctuating up and down, and then hard 300s after that. And he's like, fine. And I'm just like, my whole body's cramping up. So,
wow, some real race specific work. I mean, is he swoosh track club now?
He's swoosh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, are you sort of putting him, are you still saying we're going to see big things from Bosley in the next 6 months?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, he's a great guy, and I think we've seen what he's capable of. He's been dealing with some injury stuff the year before this, and I think, you know, unfortunately he suffered his knee flared up before Nationals, and I don't think we got to see the best of Drew at Outdoor Nationals, but yeah, I hope he can kind of keep the momentum that he was building, and yeah, keep progressing from there.
And what's next for you then? So obviously coming off the back of World Cross, have you had a little bit of downtime at all, or is it straight back in training and next race is on the horizon?
Yeah, straight back into it, I think. I'll be looking to take a break in March. I'm planning to do the Sound 10K at the end of March, just because there's barely any fast 10Ks in the world, so you're very limited as to what you can try and choose from there. But yeah, that's like the next big aim would be the Sound 10K, try and like bridge the gap between what I've ran and like, you know, like these world qualifying times. I think the UK B standard was like 27:20 or something last year. Yeah. So I think, you know, there's no world champs or anything this year, but if I can start bridging that gap down to that 27 flat area would be ideal. If we can go 27 sub 27:30 or something like that, that would be huge. But other than that, I'm just going to do a 5K in February. I'm deciding between Boston and there's a Sound meet in Winston-Salem, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
One of those two will be the next race. So just a bit more 5K specific work over the next few weeks.
Talking to 10Ks, mate. Day after World Cross, what did you make of it? Valencia, those times that the Brits posted. What are your thoughts on that? Did you, even though it was day after World Cross, was a part of you like, God, I wish I was in that as well?
Yeah. I mean, when you go and see guys run as fast as they did, it's, you know, you're always like, I wish I was in there, you know. But I think World Cross was more important to me. And, you know, there's a lot of 10Ks throughout the year, so I couldn't leave the country anyway, but I didn't really see the need of, you know, going to do a fast 10K when World Cross was on the cards. So yeah. I would have loved to have been in there, but hopefully there'll be plenty more other opportunities in the future to try and run fast. And I think it's just great to see, you know. I think there's been a bit of a gap in British 10K running for a little while now, so I think it's good to see, you know, the competition is there, and I think, you know, we can as a nation improve a lot in the 10K, and it's good to see the guys are starting to bridge that gap a little bit. You know, the more competition, the better, as far as I'm concerned. You know, it's only going to push me to be better.
Without a doubt. And we haven't even asked on the World Cross, what was the atmosphere like on the ground? Was, you know, I sort of look at the World Cross as a bit of a bucket list event. And so, yeah, when you weigh up Valencia World Cross, you know, when you look back on your career, you're probably going to remember World Cross very, very fondly compared to a few runs out in Valencia. But what was it like, the race, the atmosphere of the event?
Yeah, I loved every second of it, honestly. I think there was over like 10,000 people there, which for cross country is pretty impressive. You know, it doesn't get the hype of, you know, some of the major like track championships, but I think 10K in Florida is a pretty good turnout. And, you know, I knew so many people from Florida that it kind of felt like it was a bit of a weird experience, I think, because it's like, it's not my home country and it's like nowhere near where I'm from, but like, you know, to have that many people shouting for you, it was a really cool experience. And yeah, something I'll never forget. Like, I couldn't tell you anything that happened in that race, but like the atmosphere and post-race, pre-race, everything was just like, yeah, definitely something that it's like memorable and take for like forward in my career, and just something that I'll always, yeah, look back on with pretty fond memories.
Did you Seminoles get treated differently to everyone else? Do you get special treatment, special service?
Yeah, no special service pre-race or anything, but yeah, definitely like after the support. Race, everyone was like coming up to me saying like, go Knowles, and doing the chop and everything. And yeah, like loads of people wanted autographs, and I'm like, you only know me because I'm from Florida. Like, I came 26th, I'm not like that big of a deal, but you know.
Hey, take it.
Yeah, definitely. It's weird because like they're asking for autographs off me, and then like Nico Young's walking behind me, and I'm like, yeah, not the guy you should be getting an autograph.
You put him away. I mean, it's just, that must give you a lot of confidence now. I just think, you know, beating guys like that. That's something which is quite nice about cross, is like, you're probably not going to get the opportunity to toe the line against that level of runner, you know. You might do in the next 18 months or 2 years, you know, maybe you get on the Diamond League, but it's rare you get the opportunity to stand next to those guys and share a start line and compete like that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, these are guys that you look up to like for years and years, and like to get to race against them is such a unique opportunity, and I think you can learn so much from that. And yeah, I think, you know, you never really learn. The only way you get to see what level you're truly at is to race against the best in the world. And, you know, that's why I couldn't turn down the World Cross opportunity, because, like, when else am I going to race them, you know? It could be years, and, like, I can take lessons from this and know that I can compete against these guys, even if it's a track championships that I do end up racing against them. Like, I've competed against them before. So if I do end up reaching that level, then it, like, that isn't my first experience of this whole thing. Like, I've raced them previously. And yeah, like, that's why I wanted to race it so much, was like, because there were some of the best guys in the world there.
Yeah, that's a no-brainer. Yeah.
And just on the 10K, obviously you mentioned it before, do you see that as the event where you can go and race these guys in the future? Because I think, man, I've been discussing quite a lot recently that the British guys seem to either be thinking, okay, can I get that 5K standard? Or if not, I'm going to go run a marathon. And it seems like that 10K time is so hard, and because the races are so hard to find, and obviously there's no heat, so it's just the guys in. Is that something that push you off, or are you thinking, no, this is my best event, and that's what I can go and nail in the next couple of years?
Yeah, I think in definitely in terms of track championships, I think it's going to be the 10K. I think it suits me pretty well. Like, I'm not like a raw speed type guy, but like, I can still close reasonably well. Like, I can close in a 55, 56 at the end of a 10K, like right now. So, you know, that still needs a bit of work, but it's kind of in the locker. Now I just need to get to the point where I can run 27 flat. That's the hardest part of it. But yeah, I think we're seeing a lot of guys transition to the marathon because, one, it's so hard to make the 10K. Like, 27 flat is insanely fast. It's like 13:30 twice. Like, that is on a different level. Like, that is insanely difficult. And I think a lot of guys are just like, you know, the money's in the road. If I can go and run a good half marathon, then, you know, I'm set for the next however many years. But the 10K is definitely difficult. Yeah.
One thing I would say about you is you're in a place where guys have done that. And I think that's probably the most important thing, is you have now surrounded yourself with, you know, Nico Young is close by, you know, you've been associated with him for a while. And yeah, there's a couple of other people in that Flagstaff area. You know, I don't know if you bump into Adrian Wildschut, and, you know, you mentioned, you know, Amir Mohammed as well. Like, these guys have run the 27 lows, the 26 50s that you want to go and do. And I think over here in the UK, it's, you know, there's no one that anyone can relate to who's sort of gone that quick or sort of probably even knows how to get to that level. So I think you're in the right place to do it.
Yeah, that was kind of my thought process about like trying to stay in Flagstaff.
Yeah.
There's so many people up here that have been there and done it. And, you know, I think what's good as well is you can kind of see like these guys that are running these 27 flats can also go and run half marathons. I think the training philosophy right now fits perfectly with running anything from a mile up to a half marathons. You know, these guys do it on regular occasions. I mean, we just saw Adrian, who's been on the 10K track for years. He just went and ran, what, like 59 lows something for the half marathon. So, you know, I can still, if I end up signing for someone, wants me to go run half marathons, I know that I can also like drop down and run track 10Ks if I can get into that wheelhouse of competing with these guys. So, yeah, I think over the next 2 years, just see how good I can get over the 10K track while also doing some road stuff as well.
So from what you've seen, you think that anyone from sort of a mile or 3K all the way up to a half is training quite, you know, their training is very, very similar, basically.
Yeah, I think now it's with the Norwegian philosophy, I think like most people are doing double Ts, like a lot of threshold tempo work. And the only difference that you can like see consistently is like when people drop specifically in to do certain workouts, like a mile workout is obviously going to be a lot different to a 10K workout, but that specific workouts might only come 4 to 6 weeks before you start racing for that event. You know what I mean? So for most of the year, most people are just doing threshold of some kind, and they're still getting those neuromuscular stimulus in with through like hill repeats and stuff like that. So I don't think it's too different. I think that's why you can see like Joe Wigfield's a perfect example. I mean, he just ran what 146 over the summer and then what 62 for half marathon on his debut. I think it all hands itself to each other.
Absolutely. Well, look, Dave, thanks so much for chatting to us today. We wish you all the best going forward, and hope to see you kind of racing back in the UK as well, once you sort your visa and stuff.
I'll be back.
I hope you can leave the US.
I need to soon.
Right. Yeah, best of luck, mate. Thanks for coming on,
boys. Yeah.